Okay, welcome back to Coast AM. All right, this hour, we call it Conversations with Linda. Give you that chance once a month to talk with her about stories that you deem important. And if you're a government whistleblower, check in with us as well. Back with your calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Linda Moulton Howe with us and your calls. Linda, have you heard of the story of the Black Knight satellite, which is supposed to be this 13,000-year-old satellite that's orbiting out there around the moon and the Earth, and that it came from a different star system?
Well, not specifically, but there's been a kind of genre, I think, since Sitchin's work, where people have been talking about something orbiting in our solar system somewhere for a long time, with maybe Sumerian Anunnaki coming back. And it, all of this stuff seems to be shavings off of that same core story. But I don't know of any hard science that supports any of it. Do you?
No, not yet. It's a great story, though. Great story. I'd like to check into it. You never know. You cross over, though, between two different versions. And you know, on one end, you do cover the supernatural and paranormal with a scientific twist. And then you cover hard science as well. Do you find that difficult to balance that?
No. In fact, if you go back to when I was at Stanford University and I was producing films for the Medical Center and the Stanford Linear Accelerator, and then I went into hard news at KNBC, I was covering everything. And then I was asked to work in the documentary department and was again back on science, environment, and medical issues. So by the time that I started trying to get into the animal mutilations and what was at the bottom of that, and had law enforcement telling me that the perpetrators were creatures from outer space, that came as a big shock to me back then. I still can remember how it felt like a 220-volt circuit hitting me when Sheriff Tex Graves said that to me. But I went ahead to try to develop facts. I truly, truly honor the pressure of facts, and I have no question that non-human intelligences are involved in the animal mutilations of this planet and have been globally for centuries. Well, that led to hundreds of other subjects, but always in the context of the same thing that I've always done, which is science, environment, and medicine. And I knew that when I started Earth Files, as my web complement to what I was doing in television and radio, that I wanted to make sure that I was always had my feet grounded in science, environment, and medicine at the website, and there would then be the real X-Files component, which I think of as the place where I can't prove anything, I can't provide a paper trail, I often can't provide the people because they're either running scared or they sign non-disclosure agreements, but they want me to know something. And so I put those reports in the Real X Files, but everything that I do is in the same context with the same rules from Stanford on, trying to get multiply witnesses, physical evidence, and always looking for the pressure of fact.
Well, you know, we've got to get you on our Beyond Belief television show in Denver, get you back in that area again.
I would love to. I would really love to.
We shall. Let's take some calls here for you, Linda. They're lining up. We'll pick it up by going to Asheville, North Carolina. Eric, thanks for calling. Go ahead. You're on Coast to Coast.
Oh, wow. What a privilege. Thank you both for accepting my call.
You're welcome.
Miss Howell, I both of you are just troopers for the truth. I've got to give it to you. And you're the reason I work at night while my son sleeps.
Thank you.
Something I've personally observed, and I was wondering if you had noticed, since 2010, our moon's been flipping 180 degrees a night. Optically, you can see the craters actually move across clockwise on the moon face. 2 months ago, the shadow began to follow it. It is no longer a crescent moon. It's almost like somebody turned on a neon light a couple years ago, and now it's starting to flash. The shadow is actually moving 180 degrees across the moon each and every night. When you watch it at 4 hour periods, you can tell 20 to 25 degrees across the face of the moon like a clock. The shadow and the craters are both moving. Now, I looked at why. NASA claims that a brown dwarf, G1.9, had moved in close to Pluto. I'm sure you remember this. The thing is, if you look at the Hubble data from where they're discussing binary systems, never does a binary star stop at the outer planet. It always circles the sun. And this is 3 years ago. At Christmas, I watched Orion. I used to drive USS Texas and USS Arkansas, so I'm helmsman qualified, and I know my stars. I watched Orion bounce across my horizon 40 degrees and back every week up until recently when I've been watching the sun rise north of east and set almost due north. I can't believe people are missing this stuff. But I have moved from Los Angeles to the top of a mountain near North Carolina in Asheville here. And I can see the sky really good.
What's happening out there, Linda?
I'm listening to you. And I am an amateur astronomer, have been since I was 4 years old and had a little reflector. And I always look at the moon, and I have never seen what you're describing. And that includes looking at the moon with some strong binoculars just recently. And I've never seen anything of what you're describing. And so I am baffled at your description.
Now, let's get back to the sinkholes for just a second. If something's happening indeed to the planet, and these sinkholes are happening all over the place, could the entire structure of the planet just collapse?
No. The geophysicist said in answer to a question that I had sent, and I'll be writing more about this coming week at Earth Files, update, very interesting information. But the bottom line is, when you look back through the 4.6 billion years of this planet in solar system history, and we know that there was a Gondwana land, and that's when all of the continents were sort of massed together. And then there were all these forces working from the inner core of this planet up through the mantle where the lava is and up into the crust, and breaking out, that there was enough pressure at various times to crack open Gondwana land into the continents as they evolved into where we are today. But that doesn't mean that there's any stop sign out there to these processes that work on this planet. And right now, I think that there is increasing evidence. It isn't coming just from the geophysicist, that there are changes in the Earth's core, and that would affect what is happening in the mantle and the lava flow, which would affect volcanoes and seismic activity. And what he is suggesting is that there is a change that is causing soil liquefaction, and that means that there are changes happening on the crust then that could be related to the sinkholes, the booms, and perhaps the lakeport houses falling into the ground, and that those changes would be part of the natural dynamic of this planet for 4.5 billion years. And we have come through what you would say has been a reasonably stable time of the Earth since the last ice age ended around 12,000 years ago, and that we are in a period of time where we are supposed to be heading toward a more dusty arm in the galaxy. The Earth is at various cycles. For example, what might happen in Yellowstone? There were periods of the gigantic explosions that created the Yellowstone caldera, and the last one was 640,000 years ago. Well, what if there are cycles to all of this that are a dynamic of this planet, and we happen to be living at a time when the changes are going to occur, and the geophysicist said the worst case would be that there would be another crack, a in a plate, like in Indonesia. They're looking at that. What would happen? I don't know that anybody knows. They're probably creating computer models to generate various forces. But the Earth has been through this over and over and over again, and now we're a surface life that might be affected in some parts of the planet if there were such a change. But I really think, don't you, George, that we all should know what scientists and government people are learning about our own planet.
We should know.
And that if it might affect somebody who said, well, I'm not going to live in Jakarta then. I have no idea what people would think, but I don't think that people are going to be running out into the streets. I think we would welcome and value more knowledge, and that this planet is changing always, just like the sun changes. I don't know anything about what this man was talking about, seeing changes on the moon. I'm not aware of a single thing like that. And when it comes to that brown dwarf, it's Michael Brown. He is a scientist that I've interviewed two or three times. He was the one who discovered Sedna and that whole variety of things out at the Kuiper Belt and beyond in the Oort cloud. Mm-hmm. Michael Brown is a PhD astronomer from Caltech, and he has had a career of breaking news. And he is the one who reported that this object, this goes back several years ago, that he hypothesizes that there is an object out somewhere between the Kuiper Belt and the Oort cloud that is probably a brown dwarf. That means it was an object that would have gone into becoming a sun and didn't make it, and that's why they're called brown dwarfs, and that maybe this would have been a binary star system. That star is that brown dwarf's a long way out there. And that when you look at this section of the Milky Way galaxy, it is a fact that we are in an arm and in a section where binary stars are more common, or as common as single stars, and that we are in an arm area where there are lots of spectral stars, very similar to our yellow, or they might be a little cooler orange or a slightly different color, but we are in a kind of garden of similar suns, and that the idea that this would have been a binary star system is not unusual at all, that we would have a brown dwarf out there that just never made it to the full sun in the evolution of this solar system.
Okay, let's go to some other calls. We'll go to Denise in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Welcome to the program. Hi, Denise.
Hi, George. How are you?
I am well. Thanks.
I am so grateful for you, George and Linda.
Thank you.
And Art. I've been listening 17 years.
Good for you.
Yeah, I love you so much. I have a question about Morgellons. I've been dealing with that for about 13 years, and it's a nightmare. And since you're talking about GMO tonight and chemtrails, I just wondered if there was any news, new studies, any help.
Well, you know, that's a possibility, Linda, that could be tied into GMOs. Who knows?
I think that the Morgellon syndrome is one of the most puzzling, baffling stories that I have ever encountered, because I have talked with a nurse who was practical and grounded. This was about 8 years ago, and she was pulling what looked like these hair-like things, winding them out of her skin, which is what people describe. And yet, when her evidence was presented to, I believe it was one of the California HMOs, wanted to have research from doctors so that they could decide whether they would insure this and say that it was a real syndrome or not, it was denied. And there are people who write me frequently saying that they think that they have the Morgellon syndrome of these fibers in the skin that cause lesions and that they pull things out. But in the medical community still, after all of these challenges and alleged efforts to take research and get it into mainstream medicine, nothing has stuck. And I don't understand why. If you interview a wide variety of medical people, and I talk with a lot, and they say that they can't find the hard data that they need to establish this as a disease, and yet people from all walks of life, all over the place geographically, report this same strange syndrome of sores and feeling like that they're pulling these tendrils out. Could it be that there is something out there in the environment, like a fungi, a fungus, that is somehow getting into skin and causing problems in some people, but for some reason can't be identified under a microscope or DNA or whatever the issue? And that, to me, is the challenge about reporting and researching about Morgellons. We need medical authorities to discuss this, because you, I, and others, we're not doctors, we're not medical doctors. And if I, as a reporter, go to a medical doctor and say, I want to know about this syndrome, and they say there's nothing to know, we're caught in a Chinese torture that people have real and substantive complaints, and they take photographs. But on the other side, the medical community is not behind saying that this is a syndrome. So I find this very mysterious and puzzling.
What's the latest? Do you ever get involved in Bigfoot research?
Oh, yes. A decade ago, I interviewed Jeff Meldrum.
Oh, sure. He's a good man. As a matter of fact, they're up there looking. I think they're looking around your neck of the woods in New Mexico.
Right.
Thermal imaging has seen a 7-foot creature running around out there.
Well, I still can remember being impressed by Jeff Meldrum's anthropology approach to the Sasquatch in the Northwest, where he was, I think it was Oregon State University or one of those colleges there. And he is the one who introduced me to Jimmy Chilcutt down in Texas, a police officer. And Jimmy, in his work, he's retired now, but in the police department, he became famous for having a huge collection of handprints, fingerprints, toe prints, footprints of humans. And he decided, because the police department down in Texas, somebody brought in a big plaster cast of a 14 or 16 inch foot, and he was fascinated because of all of his work with other prints, and he began studying this big foot that they got in plaster Paris, and he found anomalies that were definitely not primate Homo sapiens sapiens. And that's what led Jimmy Chilcutt to work with Jeff Meldrum on Sasquatch cases, and both of them, in an interview, I think it was 10 years ago, they were strongly insistent that they feel that the evidence is absolutely there, that there is this primate-like creature, but Jimmy Chilcutt says it is not human-like and gives all the reasons for the feet. And now I understand that there have been increasing number either of sightings and or physical evidence here in the state of New Mexico.
Oh, yeah, lots of them. Linda, stick with us. We're going to come back in just a moment. We'll take final phone calls with you right here on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, we're going to take a walk on the paranormal side with Gail Godfrey, so make sure you're part of that, followed by, of course, those special open lines. And when we jump right back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM, we'll take final phone calls with Linda Moulton Howe, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Final segment with Linda Moulton Howe. Let's go right back to the phones. Let's go to Brighton, Michigan. Dan is with us, first-time caller. Hey, Dan.
Good morning, Linda and George.
Hi.
I'd love to take up, you know, the rest of this segment and ask you, about all these questions and express my concerns about all of the topics that Earth Files addresses. However, I was driven to finally call this program because I'm really struggling to find some clarity about my extraterrestrial mm-hmm. encounters. And it's like I deliver newspapers in a fairly rural area just north of Ann Arbor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, since 2010, since that time, I've had multiple and various encounters. And I would love to tell you all about these encounters, but for the sake of brevity, I was just wondering if you could possibly recommend any experts that I could possibly speak to, or any literature which may help me understand the significance.
You can talk to me. You can email me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com and say you are the fellow from Ann Arbor, and provide a phone number, and I will email back about a time that we could talk on the phone. And I would be very interested to learn what you've seen and encountered during your newspaper route.
Linda, have we been able to replace the shoes of Bud Hopkins and Dr. John Mack in that arena?
Well, there are various people in various parts of the country who do work with abductees to this day. And one of those that is still going strong and who I admire so much is Leo Sprinkle in Laramie, Wyoming. He was the director of counseling and testing at the University of Wyoming when I started working on the film A Strange Harvest at KMGH in Denver. And a lot of people don't realize is that Leo Sprinkle, in his capacity of working with college students at the University of Wyoming, was the first person that I know of in the United States to work with people in the context of abductions by non-humans. That was in the 60s for Leo. It was not until the end of the 70s that Bud Hopkins, in people he knew out on Fire Island in areas in New York, that he began to study the phenomena and work with people called experiencers or the people in human abductions. But Leo Sprinkle had been doing that quietly under the radar in the 60s and has probably the longest arc of working with the subject of anyone I know. And he has a wealth of knowledge. And I think that if Bud and John and Mac were here, they would say the same thing, that Leo Sprinkle was, in fact, maybe the first real pioneer. And then they each person picked up the baton and carried it further. And there are people out there today who are trying to help people who have encounters with lights, with beams, with various things coming through walls. Whatever the phenomena is, I think the one thing that is very clear, we've all gone past the notion that it is all strictly biological beings from some other solar system. There is too much about all of this that is very similar to what Jacques Vallée wrote about in Dimensions and Passport to, I think it was the Patagonia, and that is that we probably are dealing with multi-dimensional intelligences. We don't understand it. We use those words. We don't understand what it means to sweep your arm in front of you and perhaps be sweeping through other dimensions. Or time travel as something that is a reality in the cosmos that the 99% of humanity is not aware of, but there may be a 1% that is trying actually to do it and manipulate time. And so if humans are trying to do that, it wouldn't surprise me at all that some of the interactions with this planet are related directly to something out there trying to manipulate timelines, perhaps for good and maybe in other cases for bad. Thus, it is such a complex universe, so much more complex than we were taught when we were in grade school, and that we're all starting to come through this Alice in Wonderland together and to use these words, even if we don't understand them. And the next step, I pray, is that we are going to have a straightforward, honest introduction to other intelligence in this universe and finally get past all of the lies.
Okay, let's go to some final calls here for you, Linda. Tim in Louisville, Kentucky, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Tim.
Good evening, Linda and George. Thank you for all your work.
Thank you.
This is back to the bees And this is a serious thing.
Yes.
Very disturbing.
Yes.
I'm not sure if you brought up the quote from Einstein where he says if bees were to disappear off the face of the earth, man would only have 4 years left to live. You know, he was a pretty intelligent person, and that those are kind of haunting words. Other than boycotting Monsanto products or other products related or suspected to be...
And Bayer and Syngenta.
What can we do?
Yeah, it's the... And Dow. Those are the companies that make all this stuff.
Right.
Yeah, well, boycott. Right
boycott.
Now, I think it's...
Products, yeah.
Yeah, what, just last weekend there was that great big...
Last Saturday.
Yeah.
Nationwide, 400 cities.
Yeah, it was...
Worldwide.
It was wonderful that... people like bees pollinating flower to flower. There is beginning to be, I think, a network of people who really care, who understand how dominoes fall on this planet, that we are drowning in poisons, and that it has to stop for everyone, everything to survive, from bees to humans eventually. And why is it that these corporations can maraud this planet? Money. And somehow, in all of this, the equation of the relationship of the barter system to humanity and civilizations and how civilizations work around the barter system is something that maybe is going to be a revolution, that there has to be a different way for this planet to function in relationship to who has what and who can do what with the barter system. And that's where the whole issue of protesting and boycotting Monsanto and Dow and Bayer and Syngenta and these companies, but to do it with knowledge, to do it with the facts. They are making products that are being allowed through the Environmental Protection Agency through a bureaucratic loophole called conditional registrations. That's gobbledygook for saying we don't have the time, the money, the scientists, or anything to actually test your new poison. So we'll give you a conditional registration. You can get it out there on the market. And it's almost like saying, and then we'll see what it does. Well, we can't live like that and survive, and it's becoming clearer and clearer. And God bless all those people this past weekend who went out, because they are aware, and they just made a whole bunch more people aware. And maybe, in a way, Tom Theobald is right. If people all over the planet get knowledge, facts, they understand the consequences of what we are doing, maybe it will be another tipping point to a better future. I really hope so.
Okay, next up, we go to Tampa, Florida. Ron's turn. Thank you for holding, Ron. Go ahead.
Hi, George and Linda. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. I was wondering if climate change could be a factor in a number of these problems you've been talking about tonight, like with sinkholes. Here in Florida, we've always had problems with sinkholes, and with weather extremes being really dry in the spring with wildfires, really wet in the summer with downpours, tropical storms, you know, and sinkholes will open up like after it's been raining and then it dries out after a while.
Sure.
California has been really dry this winter with a lot of wildfires, you know, they're getting those really early, you know, and we're seeing these like downpours, like they had one in San Antonio. The Midwest went from being really dry to flooding all of a sudden. And it could have other things like more viruses, more fungi, more diseases, you know, just other problems too.
Yes, in a warming planet, there are a lot of downsides. And the geophysicist has pointed out something very interesting through the electronic engineer intermediary. If what he's saying is correct, there has been a long time monitoring of hot spots and cold spots. I'm using those words sort of dramatically to get across the idea. Hot spots and cold spots on the planet that are more varied and intense than they ever knew or expected, and that the hot spots themselves could be affecting the crust from the hot mantle in these particular areas. And that crust alone could end up from inside the Earth causing warming in some areas. If it were under a glacier would melt because of something coming in the Earth, as opposed to CO2 in the atmosphere being the only responsible player. And so what I'm beginning to realize is that I need personally to learn a great deal more about the geophysics of our planet, our Earth, and that our attention has been focused on the buildup of greenhouse gases, which is happening. There's no question that we are seeing a temperature rise. The average global temperature could go 4 to 6 degrees over the next 90 years, and that will cause all kinds of changes from animals to plants to marine life and human life. But here is this other question. We're on a planet that has forever been dynamic. It has always been changing. There are all kinds of dramatic pieces of the past of this planet, from being a snowball 3 or 4 times to having dinosaurs and ferns and no ice anywhere on the planet. It has always been dynamic. Why should we humans think that the Earth has stopped being dynamic? No. We need to understand and learn this is a very dynamic planet, and there may be coming a time when there will be huge volcanic outbursts and more earthquakes, and another piece of a plate will crack apart, and that there could be a tremendous amount of change. But to me, that is something that you learn as much as you can about, like the geophysicist is. And you find hot spots and cold spots that may themselves be setting up very unstable dynamics. And then you try to understand it, and you try to help people understand it, and why it might not be wise to be living in certain parts of the planet. That's the way I wish that the human family could live, that we all had the knowledge so that we could all make more intelligent decisions.
Do you think this planet is in the midst of a major calamity, Linda?
Calamity sounds like that there will be guaranteed catastrophe.
Yes.
And I don't know that there is guaranteed anything coming in the future. This is the, I'm giving you my best gut intuitive. I sense, and I think an awful lot of people do, it's almost like something's quivering out there in the future tangibly, like I can feel it, like you pluck the string and I can feel the vibration, and that something gigantic is going to happen. I just, like global. And I'm not so sure that it necessarily is negative. I think that there can be, just like the crop circle in the hayfield in Gray, Tennessee, it has one circle is going clockwise, another is going counterclockwise. Completely opposite directions, opposite energies. Something could compartmentalize itself in that 4-foot grass and make all these complex weaves. You look at these photographs, and it is hugely complex with herringbone weaves and all kinds of things. And then you look at the Earth and say, clockwise, counterclockwise, positive, negative, the energies come sweeping in together from those two circles to that middle bar right in the center, and they meet. Something like that may be happening on this planet, because we can't continue with 1% of the human population dominating, marauding, brutalizing, overwhelming the other 99%. Something has to change that. And in the process of all of that change, the Earth may be going through its own changes, which may ultimately make some new balancing. We need to rebalance. Humans do. The Earth does. We're in a, that's the way I would say it, George. It feels like we're in a transition toward rebalancing everything on this planet. The
planet needs to be rebooted.
Yeah.
Simple as that. Give out your websites, if you would, and any conferences coming up for you.
It's earthfiles.com, and everything I've reported tonight is on the headlines page in order with hot links to the in-depth reports with photographs and everything related. And I welcome all of your questions and new information to my email, earthfiles@earthfiles.com. And I am going to be working hard this summer on several projects. And then in the fall, another trip will be to Pittsburgh, is going to be one of the conferences where I'll be speaking in October, or no, it's the 1st of November, I think, in Pittsburgh. And I will always have at the top of my headlines page where I am speaking next. So hopefully everybody go to earthfiles.com and email me, earthfiles@earthfiles.com.
Okay. Linda, thanks again. Always good to have you on the program. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasaur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, George Knapp, John B. Wells, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere up there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.